This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to a French Village podcast. I'm here with my brilliant friend, Ben Wittes. We are talking about the first two episodes of season five. Renewed again, Ben.
Renewed again. It is 1944. It is August and liberation is at hand. And I'm really looking forward to it because, you know, Paris just fell to the Allies. We skipped over the whole Normandy thing. And I have so many questions. Can I start with my main question? Where the heck is Janine? She's just vanished.
Well, she's not vanished. So I don't know how to say this without, I will say, obviously we don't know who survives, who doesn't, whatever. But as a mini-ish spoiler, thematic spoiler, this show takes you through we know how everybody ends up. Like, either they're dead or like we see them in their old age. And so this was something actually that somebody told me when they were first recommending the show, so I don't feel bad spoiling it for other people. Have no fear.
I just want to know what happens to Janine. We saw her abandon Shasanya and he gets shot. And then she's just like gone, and it's, you know, Liberation Day, and I want resolution. Does she get away with those payments she made to the resistance? Do they string her up from a tree? Is she put on trial? I want my Janine resolution.
I mean, I feel like if there's one thing we know about the show, as we've seen with Madame Morhange and Dick Caverne, people go away for like a stretch. Like, we didn't see Tikiero for many of his formative childhood years. And then he was just like, he just showed up as like a 4-year-old.
That's true.
So I'm sorry. I'm sorry you're missing Janine. I will say, that's funny. That's your biggest question. My biggest question is, how handsome did Schwartz get in between seasons? I just feel like Resistance suits him.
I think Resistance suits him in a lot of ways. And I also think that adolescence is not serving Gustave well. You know, like, he's turned into a surly 13-year-old asshole, which is super realistic. Going to do the black market thing, nasty to his uncle. I thought that was a nice touch.
Yeah. We're going to get a teenage Gustave. He's going to be around. So I guess there's a number of things that hits us in this episode, but the one of the central things that we hadn't seen before, and I don't think we've ever talked about from a historical standpoint, is, you know, yes, liberation is at hand, but I think the show, especially in the first two episodes that we see, is trying to tell us something about the messiness of liberation. Like, it's not like the Americans march in and everyone dances in the streets. There is a slow turning of the tides in which lots of people are trying to like suss out the power dynamic. And some people, so they've got this militia, the French militia. And it's one of the scenes. So I have to be honest. Even though this is like technically something that I guess I would call like a work product, and so I'm like required to do the viewing, I fast forwarded through the scene at the farm where the militia comes,
that's an upsetting scene.
Yeah, I knew it was coming, and it already haunts me, so there's no need for me to watch it again. But the guy who does that, Alban, we hear Antoine say at one point, you know, he was with me in the resistance for a bit. And I mentioned it back in a few episodes ago when we saw him. Remember, he's the one who informed on them in the woods. Because I hadn't caught it the first time. Like, I remember Antoine saying that, me being like, wait, who was that guy? But he was the guy who was there with them for just a little bit. And then he leaves and he goes to Marchetti and he rats out their location. And so now he has joined up with this French militia, and it's led by, this is one of those sort of Mueller instances where the insanity of the moment attaches to like a psychopath. And so like this guy who leads the French militia is this psychopath who's using his authority to like go murder families in the resistance and small children. And he's got this, so this Alban guy has joined up with them, and they're basically, there's one of the central tensions for them in the episode is there's a train that's leaving and they want to be on it. Like, they're trying to get out of there. They've been killing people. They are the ultimate collaborators. And so they're trying to get out of Dodge. And yet the psychopathic leader wants them to keep, like, his whole theory on why they are losing is they're very Chassagne-like. You know, we weren't mean enough. We didn't kill enough people. And so they're trying to do it just as like a cleanup job there at the end. They're shooting people in the prisons. But what did you think about the introduction of this French militia? And does that seem historically accurate to you?
So I don't know the history of the militia in question that they're depicting here. It is certainly the case that there were a variety of fascist groups that oriented around the Pétain regime, and that the SS helped propagate. Some of which, and I don't know the details of this, some of them actually sent troops to the Eastern Front, which, you know, showed real commitment, but some of which retreated into Germany with the Germans. So I assume this is a depiction of one of those. This is actually not the first time the militia shows up. The people who arrest Larcher in season 4 and Sarah and Ezekiel are this same militia. So they kind of make a brief appearance in a quite brutal way in season 4. And now they seem to have occupied the town in the meantime. But I don't know what militia this is supposed to be depicting.
Interesting. I mean, I guess, so that's interesting that they were kind of introduced. I guess I just took them as French cops before of some kind, but now that you're right.
They were uniformed and they're not gendarmes.
And
they're sort of particularly brutal and Jew-hating. And so I think the suggestion is that these are the same militia, but I don't know for sure.
Got it. I think that they're given kind of a central role here to demonstrate this sort of purgatory of just about to be liberated towns. Because, you know, there's this interesting, you know, I think Mueller is telling them to go, like, just shoot the hostages, like, just clean, shoot everybody who's in the prisons. And Marchetti, right, because these guys have different, people are making different calculations now. Marchetti's got a figuring out, like, how are we going to live in this town now that the, you know, the Germans are, like, on the precipice of losing the war. And the Germans are kind of like, let's just kill everybody we can on the way out the door. And so while Mueller's ordering people to go kill every last Jew that they can find or anybody else who's in prison, Marchetti says, let the last 12 go. Like, just let them out. Like, he's sort of like, I don't want to keep committing these crimes in the face of this town that's about to turn on me. And in fact, one of the other interesting dynamics is, like, the resistance is now, everyone knows they're about to be in charge. And so, you know, the cops like Marchetti and people like Servier are trying to figure out, okay, well, who do we negotiate with so that we don't get killed when this whole thing's over. Like they sort of know, they have like a, they have the glimpse of the idea that justice is coming. And so like in one case, Servier asked Larcher to go negotiate with Marie that, you know, they will let those guys live. And Marie kind of says, no, and let all the people out of prison or you'll be in big trouble.
Right.
So power dynamics have shifted here.
So the main militia was called the Milice Française, Milice, I think. And it was, this kind of fascist far-right group of people that were organized by the Pétain regime and mostly as the show depicts, fought resistance people. They were very brutal, a lot of them, a bunch of them. I don't know that it was one organization, but as opposed to a number of them, but a number of them did retreat with the Nazis and a whole bunch of them were executed after the war. Or in this period of recapture. But yeah, they're kind of introduced without a lot of explanation.
Yeah, and they're now like occupying the police station. But I guess my main point is that thematically, what we're watching is an uneven kind of liberation in which the power dynamics are shifting and sort of opaque. Because the Germans are still killing people. People are still afraid of them. And yet everyone knows liberation's at hand. People are trying to suck up to the resistance. The people who have been hardcore collaborators, especially in the later half of the war, are starting to get nervous in these scenes. People who, you know, like Schwartz is now full on resistance, just hanging out with them in the woods. And people like, you know, one of the main storylines in these two episodes is Mueller has to make a decision. Like he's sort of got two choices. It's an interesting scene, I think. I'd be interested in what you think, where he's kind of saying, like, there's no good choice for me. Because he either goes with Hortense and flees and becomes a deserter, and if they catch him, they'll shoot him. He can't stay in France with Hortense because they'll shoot him. And he can't take her to Germany with him. Because they'll shoot her, I guess, or like they're not married, so she can't come in. Because that is one of the things that's interesting to me. Like there's a lot of different nationalities suddenly in these episodes, right? The Americans are there, the French, the Germans, and people are all kind of figure out like, where do I go to live through this next phase?
Yeah. So first of all, you know, being, Mueller is not wrong that being an SS guy in this period was getting increasingly dangerous. The Allies, particularly the Russians, but you know, treated the SS people differently than they treated normal German Wehrmacht. They were kind of presumptively war criminals, which, of course, in Mueller's case was a correct presumption. So he can't disappear because that's desertion, right? And then his own side will shoot him, which is what he tries to do. He can't go back into Germany because the SS people, you know, can't bring in their... you know, if he retreats with his people, he can't bring Hortense, and he does seem committed to her in his weird, creepy, bad guy kind of way. And so his conviction is, okay, I've got to vanish into Switzerland. And that's the, you know, the way that he's pretending to be a German civilian. And that's the way he can you know, have his cake and eat it too. as to your point about the resistance being super, or the liberation being super uneven, this is true, and the scale of it is amazing. So, you know, the landing of on the beaches of Normandy, which is in June of 44, so 2 months before these events start, landed 2 million people in France, which is, you know, just sort of awesome as a, if you think about it as a scale, it's like, you know, landing metropolitan Washington, D.C. on the Normandy beaches. Paris is liberated 2 months later in August of 44. So they cover that distance pretty quickly. But then the regime retreats into Germany, and the Allies kind of keep pushing the Germans back through, you know, eastern France into 45. This is some of the heaviest fighting of the war on the Western Front. And I think pockets of German resistance in France persist well into 1945. And so, you know, you have this period of months where, you know, generally speaking, the Allies are pushing the Germans out, but any given town might have, you know, a number of German soldiers, or the Germans might come back to a place, or they, you know, the militia may be in control. And so the depiction of it is quite chaotic, and you don't really know who's going to be there and who's going to be pointing a gun at you, I think is quite accurate.
And it's also sort of the essential debate that our resistance teams are having, right? Because they know liberation's at hand. And so there's sort of a dispute going between, do we kind of wait for the Allies to get here and tell us what to do and like how to be useful? Or do we start going on the attack against the Germans occupying the village and like show our people that like we did this, like we ran them out? And unsurprisingly, maybe it is surprising, I guess. But Marie, who we have seen now to be interestingly cautious in some of this, like in the last couple of, she was at the end of season four, and here she is too, sort of not wanting to go on the offense. She kind of wants to wait for instructions. Whereas Antoine and Suzanne, and ultimately Schwartz, because they have a whole fight because he's not backing her up, or she's not backing him up, either one. He thinks she's embarrassed him because she disagrees with him, because he's lame like that. But most people are on Marie's side. Like, people don't, they're not quite confident enough to go take the kind of risks that they're talking about to like drive the Germans out.
I'm on Marie's side on this, and I was not on the, as you know, on the parade thing. I thought she showed very bad judgment on this, but I'm totally with her about this. She, you know, you have the U.S. Army and the Free French Army pounding their way across France. You are gravely, gravely outgunned. I mean, the Germans have heavy machine guns and you don't. Why would you sacrifice good people in order to achieve essentially non-military objectives that are going to be achieved anyway within a few days? I think she's just showing good judgment here.
Yeah, I agree too. And interestingly, you know, part of where we get kind of set off is that Antoine and Suzanne are, you know, they're ticked off. They got a fire in their belly where they want to go, you know, shoot some bad guys. And Antoine's already, it becomes clear through the episodes, like a folk hero in the town of the resistance. Like, people know his name, know he's the one who led the parade. But so they are They are in the barn, which is about to like make out. They're making out in the barn when the militia shows up to Vernay's. It's Vernay, the former, the sort of the cop who joined the resistance, and his family, his wife and two children. And so they are in the barn making out, and that's like kind of thrown at you right out, like really fast in season five. We're like, okay, Suzanne, you know, Marcel's not cold yet from the end of season four, but
well,
she's
it's
got
a full year.
I'm just kidding. You will defend Suzanne over anything, I swear.
No,
to God.
And I actually don't approve of, I don't approve of the relationship with Antoine, but that's just because I don't like Antoine. I like, you know, Marcel, who couldn't give her a commitment for after the war, she's supposed to be true to his rotting corpse. you know, come on. Suzanne gets a break here, but she should choose better than Antoine. He's kind of lame.
Okay. I like Antoine more than you do. I agree. He's like,
he's such a teenager.
Well, he's like 21, which, by the way, not to just be Sarah coming in with the weird age. I mean, there's like multiple weird relationships in these two episodes. There is Albin with his sister, where they show him before, you know, he and his sister are like, yeah. And it's super strange. Like, I'm like, oh, this clearly is his girlfriend, until he says something about sister. And I'm like, that is not how you hang out with your sister. Then two, when Suzanne and Antoine are hiding out, they go to her ex-husband's house and he's shacked up with his cousin. And I know that they're French and this is all very French stuff to do, but come on. Suzanne's what, 15 years older than Antoine?
Yeah, Suzanne's, there's an age gap there, but Antoine, who's just like barely over Marie at this point, clearly True. Goes in for the older women. And you know, he's never gotten laid before, we find out in this episode.
What do you mean? You didn't believe him when he said, of course he'd done it before?
Suzanne, let's just say Suzanne doesn't believe him. I don't like this relationship. I think Suzanne could do better. If I were matchmaking for the show, it would be Suzanne and Anselm, who I think needs a good socialist girlfriend. Wow, the Blue Angels are flying by my hotel room.
Cool.
Went by.
You know, I do think for all of the defending you do of Suzanne, setting her up with Anselm seems to be one of the meanest things you could possibly do with her. He's like a 60-year-old farmer. She's like at least like 35. Anyway, look
the choice of men right now, a lot of them are getting killed, but we're dealing with slim pickings here.
It's true, but you can't. I'll tell you one thing Antoine and Marie, or Antoine and Suzanne, they both have a type. Because Antoine likes his older resistance women, and Suzanne likes her sort of weirdly distant resistance men.
Yeah, she goes for the emotionally unavailable.
She does. She does. Because like clearly something's going on with Antoine, where we're like, he's sort of into this, but he only maybe halfway. Anyway, so they are hiding. They're having a smooch in the barn when the militia shows up and murders Vernay and his family, which is a harrowing scene. And so they have to go. So they decide that what they're going to do is they are going to kill, I guess John Vierre is his name, who is the head of the militia, the psychopath I referenced earlier. And so a lot of the action in the first episode revolves around them setting up a mission where they're going to go. An unauthorized mission, right. So they've had this disagreement. The resistance has decided to hold steady. Marie wins the day, but Antoine and Suzanne, they're angry after witnessing this, justifiably so. And they decide to, do an off-book mission to go kill John Vier. Or whatever his name is. And that the first episode ends kind of in a shootout where you know, they go in and Janvier is having dinner with Albin and his sister, whose sister is important, actually. She becomes sort of a more major character. And so it's notable that part of what's happening at the dinner, the dynamic, is that this Janvier, who Albin refers to as the godfather, his godfather, that he shot those kids on Janvier's orders, Albin did. And it clearly Albin doesn't feel good about this decision. And his sister keeps asking him what he's talking about in terms of the thing that he did, because Albin kind of keeps referencing that he did this thing. And so the three of them are having dinner. She's totally creeped out by this guy because he's a total creep. But they don't realize, Antoine and Suzanne don't realize when they go in there that there's more than Janvier in the house. And so it becomes a bit of a chaotic shootout out of the gate.
Yeah. So first of all, this crime is probably the single worst crime we've seen in the show so far. This is, they kill not just him, the cop resistance mem, in front of his wife, not just his wife, but also his two small children in cold blood. And Albin does it at the kind of threatening taunt of his godfather, clearly doesn't feel good about it. He's a weak person who's led on. He's not an instigator, but handed a gun and pointed to two children. He does shoot them. That is the two of them plus some of the others who were there, including the older man who becomes sort of the head of the militia when Janvier is killed. This is the single worst crime that we've seen in the show. And it's not perpetrated by Germans. It's perpetrated by increasingly desperate French.
Yeah, and can I just ask you a question on this part? Because I guess the one thing that struck me both times, I hate this scene so much, it stuck with me, I'll probably never forget it. But why? I understand Janvier is a psychopath. But like, what does Albin think is going to happen? Like what I feel like it's so late in the game that to be committing these kind of war crimes at this point, I referenced this before, that there's this period of time where I watched Band of Brothers not that long ago. And one of the things that somebody says is that as they got closer to the end of the war, there was this feeling that would descend of like, oh my gosh, we might survive this. And so everybody starts being a lot more careful, like in a way that they were kind of careless because they had this existential sense of, yeah, I'm probably not going to make through this. And they take big risks. Like at some point people are like, wait a minute, I might live through this. And then you're much safer. These guys, knowing that it's at the end of things, I mean, and that they're maybe getting out of town, it just strikes me as an insane thing to do for a guy like Albin to put the souls of two children on his conscience.
Well, conscience is a different issue from self-interest, right? And I think the psychology of this in practice, and I think the show depicts this really well. The officials, Servier, Marchetti, are doing their best to arrange things for themselves. Let's see if we can get Danielle Larcher to meet with Marie Germain and cut us a deal, get us, you know, we'll release our resistance prisoners in exchange for certain guarantees for ourselves. The militia people don't have this option because they've been so brutal, so awful, and they're also kind of only semi-official. So they're kind of in this situation where there's no deal to cut for them. They're either retreating with the Germans or they're going to get shot on sight. And so I think the psychology of it is, why not kill the kids if it will, you know, ingratiate me to the Godfather, who may shoot me if I don't, by the way. And from the Godfather's point of view, why not engage in the atrocity if it will ingratiate me to Schneider, who, you know, makes Mueller look like a softy? Why not do it? Because the only protection you have is from the even more brutal people that you're answering to, and your safety is on the side of their of retreating with them. And so I think the desperate psychology of the situation actually favors the atrocity rather than cuts against it. Because when Anselm and Marie are in charge, you're going to get shot anyway.
Yeah, I guess that's true. And that makes sense. Well, anyway, so Antoine and Suzanne, they witness this. They decide to kill Janvier because of it. They do. And as a result, they're on the lam. They've got to go and hide out, which is why they end up at the house of her ex-husband, who is now with his cousin.
But they don't just kill him. They get into a shootout with some German troops, too, and they kill some Germans, which turns out to be significant.
It turns out to be significant in the sense that the Germans are now looking for them, and the Germans are, you know, we hear in the second episode that we watched, the Germans kind of rolling through town with the microphone, making an announcement that there's going to be reprisals, like that they're looking for these people and that they're going to take it out on the town for doing it. So this is Antoine's second thing that Antoine's done that leads to, and we learn this in the episodes, that that what was done to the town after the parade was intense. Like, people were killed. They don't show it to us, but we learn that the reprisals were significant, and it looks like we're setting it up for that to happen again.
We see one of them. We see
the
very
gets shot
beginning
with
of
the hand
in the square. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So what do you, let me ask you a moral question. Do you think that it was worth it for Antoine and Suzanne, or do you think this was reckless of them?
Totally reckless.
Because I want Janvier dead.
Oh, I want Janvier dead too. And first of all, it's possible for it to be simultaneously righteous and reckless. But I think when you have the U.S. Army coming in within a couple days behind you, the need to take risks is low. The costs of those risks is high. You're going to get these people anyway. Take a deep breath, mourn your dead, and wait. There's nothing good can come from this. Even if you get him, which they do, you're going to get a lot of people in Villeneuve killed.
Right.
And I'm totally with Marie on this. I think, you know, time is on your side. As the Taliban would say, the Westerners have the watches, but we have the time.
Yeah. Let's talk about Servier for a second. Because one of the interesting things, right, you want these episodes to be so satisfying. Like, you want the Americans to just march in and you want our people to be happy. But instead, of course, like, people here can't have nice things. And so, but one of the more satisfying elements is the fear as watching people like Servier and Marchetti freak out. Not in the way that they say anything, but just in, I mean, Servier, the guy playing him, is good. He's like, he's just like, and he's just like the perfect, like, pencil pushing bureaucrat. And I love how Servier sounds like sniveling and like a servant.
And his line that he repeats a couple times over these episodes: "We represent a legal authority that is soon to be replaced with another legal authority." And you know, the story that he's telling himself about how his behavior is not murderous and abominable, but in the regular order of things, is a wonderful portrayal of how people must have justified themselves.
Completely. He is one of the things that I like about Servier actually as a character is whereas I think there's a lot of resistance people, there's a lot of bad guys. Like we get to see a lot of gradations. There's really just him standing in for the sort of complicit state and the go along bureaucracy. And he gives you all of it. He carries that perfectly kind of alone.
Well, there's others. I mean, Larchet is part of that too, as are the non-Mercati police officers, you know, the ones who are not savages like him, but who are just kind of doing their jobs, and their jobs really suck.
So can I say that the difference to me, so those guys are part of the system for sure, the cops. The thing about Servier, and this is what I mean where I feel like we don't see a lot of it, like he's in a different tier, right? He's in the, I still have coffee. I never actually suffered a day of deprivation from this. I traded favors and got my hands, you know, or got my nephew out when he got in trouble. And I guess, you know, the people who are sort of, you see like him are kind of like Chassagne. But the thing is, the thing about Servier that to me is different, Chassagne is a bad guy. And I think Daniel's a good guy. And like Servier is the banality of evil. He's not a bad person exactly, right? Like he doesn't beat his wife or shoot people, and he feels sick to his stomach over deaths, but he carries out the atrocity with a kind of efficiency that I think is unique in the show.
I guess. I think you're being a little bit soft on him. He's not a true believer like Chassagne, but he is a, you know, he believes in the deportations of Jews that he's engaged in, as long as they're not French Jews. And his only reservation about his participation in that is that Madame Morhange, who he knows to be French, gets wrapped up in it. When the Germans decide to kill Chassagne, he's not particularly exercised about it. I think he's a kind of, I don't quite know how to describe it. He's a functionary of a state whose morality he never questions. And he believes that the service of that state is the highest value that he can represent. And he doesn't care very much that that state is engaged in evil.
Well, I guess that I thought the banality of evil was an indictment. I was trying to indict him with that because I think he's very bad. But for all of the reasons that you just stated, but he's also like he thinks that he has a noble purpose and he has a story that he tells himself, and he's not. When I say the banality of evil, it's still evil.
It's not a psycho.
Right, right. He's not Mueller. He's not Janvier. He's and for a while he's like, he and Daniel are kind of the same a little bit, except we see all this other stuff Daniel does that is for the good. Servier has none of that.
Yes, and we also see a lot of scenes where Danielle is wrestling with it, and Danielle is arguing with him for different policies. He's what the Russians call an apparatchik.
Right. Yeah. Bad. Anyway, let's talk quickly about Mueller and Hortense, because Mueller, to my surprise, chooses romance. And this is like, what's that movie, Natural Born Killers, you know, with Woody Harrelson and Juliette Lewis? And they're just like psychos in love. That's what was going through my head as I watched him put on these civilian clothes and them have this like, the first they fight for a while and like she basically says how much she doesn't really care about Gustav. And he's kind of teasing.
He says, I like him. Yeah, he likes Gustav.
He's like, I kind of like him. But he's also like giving her, you know, a hard time for like, wondering if Gustav's okay. And you know, and then they marry each other. They hold like a fake ceremony or like an emotional personal ceremony, and they put their fingers through some scissor holes as a consummation. But I will say, it gives me meaning to like, hey, you two crazy kids, because they are on their way. There's this great scene where they pull over just to, like, have a snack, and these American soldiers kind of roll up and they both freak out. You can see that they think this is the end for them. And instead it's just like a couple of dudes being like, which way is Mossy? And like, we're lost. But you know how dire the situation is for them as they drive. And they also realize actually in that scene that there's no way for them to get to the Swiss border. Like the soldiers are quickly closing in around them. Were you surprised though that Mueller didn't just like abandon Hortense and leave her behind?
Yes. And I think there's a few ways to read it, right? One is that he's looking for a way out, and escaping with her is a way out. The second is that he's looking for, you know, that some part of him is actually loves her or whatever in his weird psyche passes for love or affection or attachment. And a third possibility is that it's actually a screenwriting error, you know, and it's so out of character that, you know, it's really more of a plot device than anything else. I mean, he remains, in my view, the best played character in the entire show. And I find him, you know, riveting to watch in his civilian clothes as the SS officer pretending to be the German civilian with the French wife driving through the countryside. And he's still so horrible in his interactions with her, but he's charming and, you know, he's not killing anybody, which is, really like his most as attractive as he gets. He's not torturing anyone.
Nice so, change of pace for him. Yeah. He should get outside more often.
Yeah. So I think, you know, this trip is not going to end well for them. I think we know that actually from the credit sequence of the show, where there's a clip of a American military policeman holding Hortense by the shoulder and parading her somewhere. So we know that at some point, she at least falls into the hands of the Americans I think them running into the Americans is a kind of harbinger of something to come. That said, I don't I let's just say I doubt that they get into Switzerland and live happily ever after.
Well, let's talk. So you mentioned the Americans. I will say without spoiling anything that like the Americans are here now. So like there, you see a fair amount of the Americans. There's a great, great exchange with Marie where she's got this, she has now hooked up with the Americans. They want the French resistance to go blow up a bridge for them. They are trying to do it, but like the bomb doesn't go off and like there's a sniper shooting at them from somewhere trying to keep them from blowing up the bridge. And the Americans are trying to use, the French resistance to execute actual missions that are necessary for them. And Marie kind of, so Marie's been working with this guy now and she says, look, I want to see your commanding officer. I want to tell them they got to like march into Villeneuve because that'll shut down, you know, the reprisal killings and everything else. And like, there's this great scene where she goes to an American military base. She gets some chocolate from like the nice guy she deals with. And there was this funny part where he offers her chewing gum and she's like, what is that? He was like, you know, you chew it. And she was like, what am I, a cow? What do you mean you chew it? And then watching her, it was satisfying to like see her after so much deprivation, get a taste of chocolate. But she goes to see the commander and she like gets in an argument with him about how they should, you know, invade and save lives. And he's like, well, why would I put my guy's life on the line for your guys? That's just different lives on the line. And she kind of was like, yeah, I guess I hadn't thought about it that way. And ultimately she's kind of decides to just continue to be a good soldier with the Americans. Like she's persuaded by what he's saying and decides that they need to keep taking risks. But I say this all in service of a broader point about the Americans. It is funny in this show especially after we're just consuming so much media over my lifetime about, you know, how Americans are, to see Americans depicted by the French. And I think there's some of that in these scenes where, you know, we always see the Americans as liberators in World War II and like the guy handing out chocolate, like that feels like the American stuff that I've seen, you know, we come in and make people happy. But like the commander who's like, who is this pain in the ass woman? Like, just go do the thing I'm telling you to do. And like, yeah, you keep risking your lives and I'm not dealing with you. We're going to blow up the bridge so they can't come across it. And then we're going to, you know, we'll rebuild it when we need to go across it. And he doesn't want to deal with her. And like, that was a funny depiction of Americans. And we get more of that as this goes on.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think this is a really interesting also portrait of the differential horizon that the people of Villeneuve in the resistance and the American commanders are thinking about. From Villeneuve's point of view, liberating Villeneuve is a real priority. You know, they want the Germans out. They don't want any more massacres in Villeneuve. And from the Americans' point of view, even this region of France, it's just one of 100 places they've got to clear the Germans from in France before they get into marching into the Low Countries and Germany, right? Like they've got another year of the war left. The people of Villeneuve have another few days of the war left, and they need, and so their priorities are just totally different. And the Americans are like, who the fuck are you? And what the fuck is Villeneuve? And why are you, like, I've still got to get to Berlin before the Russians do, you know? And that's a real difference in perspective that, you know, I think this is the first time Marie is confronted with. But I do think for a reasonable person, you know, in her or for that matter, Marquette's place, right? For him, it's like when Villeneuve falls, that's the end of the world for me. But for the Americans, it's just another village on the way to Germany.
Yeah, And one of the things actually that was really interesting to me about this conversation between Marie and this guy from just a, not exactly a tactical perspective, but it becomes clear that there's going to be a retreating German army that's going to, because they're talking about this bridge and it's like, oh, wait. So not only, yes, like this town might be liberated, but like the retreating German army is coming back through. there's this going to be this whole period of time where, a defeated and depleted sort of German group of people are still going to be, everybody's still got to move from place to place. And so it's not quite over yet in that regard.
Yeah.
So just one piece of foreshadowing that we hear in this episode that for me was a little bit exciting as we go get into the fifth season here is that one of the things Servier talks about is that there's been a new prefecture appointed and that his name is De Cavern.
Yeah.
And so
he's coming back.
He's coming back. But so not only is it like, oh, and it like who knows where this guy's been. And like he did come back for like just for Morhange's death for like a scene. And then like we don't see him again. He's gone. But what's more interesting than just the character coming back is the fact that somebody like De Cavern has gone somewhere and gotten into such a position that he is now being sent back as like the new legitimate government of Villeneuve, which is interesting. And I guess I wonder where it is. I mean, I guess he's in Paris. And I
probably
guess he's
London.
Sort of, oh, London. Why?
So during the war, de Gaulle was based in London. He shows up in Paris when the Allies retake Paris. So de Cavern, there was an increasingly large sort of, it was kind of a government in exile associated with what was called the Free French, which eventually organized an army, which participated in D-Day. And there were, I mean, I don't know if it was tens or hundreds of thousands of French troops who, you know, landed as part of the Free French Army. A lot of the people, you know, for, I think de Cavern's kind of disappear, you know, he's organizes this early resistance network that was doing spying, which was mostly what the resistance did early in the war as it forms. It was largely a spying operation. He then vanishes and reemerges as the new prefect at the end of the war. I think the implication is that he's been part of the Free French operation running out of London, but we may learn something later that suggests otherwise.
Yeah. Well, exciting stuff. I mean, I just got to say, you know, the fourth season's a little bit of a slog. It's good. There's like really good, there's some really good episodes, but the fifth season is a good one. Lots happening and the reckoning begins. And part of what I, as we've always talked about the show is a meditation on complicity. You always know that judgment's coming and we're getting to the judgment part. And I find that to be an interesting place, to be.
Well, would that we were getting to the judgment part in our world, that this is all a metaphor for. We're going to have to wait for that. We will be back next week. And until then, Edith, take us home.
Nous nous aimions bien tendrement. Homme s'aime tous les amants.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.